Podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 35 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. Today, my guests are Chris Beauville and John Allison of 4 Creative, soon to be of somewhere other than 4 Creative. And we had a really good chat. We've been friends for a long time. I've known them since they were in the window of Selfridges, if not before that. And they're a lovely pair of blokes, as I said on the blog post. There's also lots of really fantastic stories here about how certain things happen, certain movements upwards in their career or sideways or downwards. They didn't do the usual Watford thing. They took a slightly different route to all this. It took time, but judging by the number of awards they've picked up for the Paralympics spot, it's all culminated in a pretty high level of success for them, which is fantastic. So please enjoy our chat. One thing I'm going to mention before you listen to this is that the sound quality is a bit mucky. That's because we did it on Skype, which is what I normally record on. But because there were two of them and we were sort of doing it on video for a lot of the time as well, and then I was talking sometimes, Skype seemed to be kind of inconsistent in how it wanted to convey the sound quality. So apologies for that. It gets a lot better in the second half because we ended the call and then called back and stuff like that. So please bear with it. It's worth doing so. Apologies if it annoys you, but I think if you listen to it for a few minutes, you'll just get used to it and it'll be fine. And I really suggest that you don't miss out on all this brilliance because you wanted something recorded in an absolutely perfect way, which I never really do anyway, to be perfectly honest. The technical side is not my forte, as regular listeners will know. Anyway, enough of the apology and on with the chat. What I don't really know how you guys got together or anything like that. Do you want to just talk about that?
Yeah. From the start, all right. Yeah. Well, it's fitting because it's our 20th year together.
Wow.
Yeah, 20 years. Yeah, look at that. We don't know when we exactly teamed up. We just started working on bits and bobs together, and then it sort of just ended up together, didn't we? But we definitely, it was Manchester. What year was it? So I think we finished in 1999. It was 1996, wasn't it? It was 20 years last year, the end of last year. It didn't matter, year maths. And so we met, and because we stayed in the same halls, and Manchester Metropolitan University, and then we sort of hit it off. We're lacking, like, neither of us are sort of, we're a bit messed up, but together we kind of make a complete, lovely fashion, one rounded hole, sort of a weird Venn diagram. Yeah. So I sort of met John in the halls, and I sort of came from Greasby, from this lovely, sort of quiet little village. And then John sent me and showed me another way. I introduced Chris to my double barrel pot that I got from Athletics Palace. I don't think I ever named it. I didn't go that far. I wasn't like a huge, strong obsessive. But Chris made sure I got my homework in on time. He decrypted me, and then we found a nice happy medium. But we sort of worked on a few projects together just because we're mates, and it was still an advertising course, but it wasn't because our advertiser used a product of the 80s advertising world, and so we sort of ended up with like Venture, we didn't really get the full force of him from Sherwood, and so we kind of had to make it up ourselves.
He'd say the same things over and over and just be kind of really aggressive and say things like, he was really divisive. His group was about 30 people, and then by the end of it had 3 people. He said provocative, shocking things. And it was designed to get you think out of your sort of, your thought prisons, but it offended everybody. But we really liked it because, it was just so kind of shocking and out there. So we never really had a proper schooling in advertising. you know, the rules, the strategies and things like that. So we just spent 3 years kind of making things, but just sort of exploring conceptual thinking and didn't really apply it to anything.
We made weird films that made no sense, basically.
So we go and find the drama course and then we sort of get some sort of victims from there in the first year drama students and then go and make a weird short film that lasted 17 minutes because we couldn't really do anything. and invent the whole language. You know, spend ages and ages on all this detail and no one would ever see it. And Tune's probably never even watched it. But it was fun. It was fun. And we sort of finished it, but then the DAD course was on and we got the brief for that. And it was
the strongest torch, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the strongest torch. And so we sort of worked together a bit, and you know, obviously we were mates, so we just thought, okay, should we have a go at this? And so it was almost like a little test, where we'd gone to our flats by then, we'd sort of moved out, and my brother was still in Manchester, my younger brother, the eldest. And so we borrowed his flat, we got a massive stack of VHSs, loads of kind of reconstituted porn products, some kind of random art house films, and we didn't argue. It was sort of like when you just about to get serious with them, you go camping with a bait or something, just to, you know, you're sort of laying there. And then about a day later, we got a letter, and sort of going, you're on. You're on the course, come down, it starts in 2 weeks, I think it was. It was a bit like, ah! What do we do? And so we just kind of forced our hand, it forced us to just come to London, yeah. Just kicked on people's beds and floors, sofas and whatever, and then just slowly found our way into the industry. But it took us 2 years, once we're in London, it took us 2 years to get a job. Because we hadn't been to school, we didn't know what we would do, we sort of make it up. Our portfolio made no sense. It was nonsense. People would always, they'd always have a meeting with us once they'd seen our portfolio because it was so wrong and so bad. But there was something about how wrong it was that they found interesting. And so we saw some really, really great people once. and then that was it. We'd never seen a portfolio. We didn't know what a portfolio looked like, what it was supposed to be, because we weren't from Watford. So we just sort of banged up for about a year and a half.
And we were terrified.
Yeah. Nigel Roberts and Paul Melford and Nigel Roberts. They were the first people we went to see. And it was just like, you call them. No, you call them. You got a phone. And they asked, they brought them weird. And then we went to see them at Tudor Rails Head.
Yeah.
And they were both in suits. Black t-shirts underneath. And they were black loafers. It's either whether they were both going to some Gucci funeral or something, or whether that was a wrong dress, but it was intimidating as fuck.
And it ripped us to shreds.
And it was just like, oh. And it just scared the absolute Jesus. It took us a long time to recover from that.
Yeah.
I'll say it was,
yeah.
But we still would find friends. We'd find like Ewan Patterson, who was a good friend of ours. Like, we'd sort of latched onto him. He was at,
BMP, wasn't it?
Yeah, BMP. And so he would see him every now and again and would just need help us. Mickey Tudor and Brian at Lowe at the time. And Drew Lloyd.
Andrew Lloyd,
HHTL, which is our like mecca. And we desperately wanted to work.
It was awesome.
Really, it was just, we did a university, we did a talk about it, didn't we? We got everybody sitting on the floor and all shit. But we were obsessed with HHTL.
Yeah.
So we were trying to get, so we had all these bit of people who would see us, even though we clearly couldn't do it.
But we didn't know how to do it.
Because we didn't have any placements or anything like that. We were sort of, we do market research jobs on the phone. So I go to jobs about 8 o'clock in the morning. And we had a routine and we'd go around and we'd just work on the book and we'd be polishing these turds. And we got one placement at BMT through you and Patrick.
Yeah,
it was a total sympathy placement. It was just like we'd seen it so many times we'd have to go on and win. And then we were there for 3 months and we sort of did some stuff, did a little thing for VW, but then we're out. And we thought, oh, this is it, this is amazing, isn't it? And we found thing on the photocopier saying they weren't going to keep us on.
Oh, that's like, sad.
Oh, it's horrible.
Because again, BW advertising was the bomb, wasn't it, at the time? So we did this for second Volkswagen. It was like they were like, yeah, this is going to run. It's going to be great. And then we just found it on the copier saying rejected or blown out. And then we knew that was it. That was the end of our placement. So we went to their summer party and we just put as much of their booze as we could in our bag. You get the large wine containers. We were taking them out of the boxes, space-wise. Because you could fit more in your bag. But then it was a year and a half into it. That was when we started to be thinking, right? Yeah. And then they sat us down and we're like, oh, you just started then, lads. And we're like, no. Then they sat us down. Well, we're like, where's your ideas? Where's your strategies? Where's it? And then they sort of drilled into us about strategies and ideas. And then, so we go in to see them, lads. And then the book sort of started changing because we were able to suddenly have this rigor, this idea rigor of, based on an insight and a truth mark and stuff. But sprinkled in with all this weirdness that we've sort of done and not knowing what a portfolio should be like. And then suddenly it sort of started taking off, didn't it? We sort of won this Cream exhibition, I think it was. We got a placement on that, but it was in grey. So grey now, amazing. Grey then was grey. It was and then we were like, when did we got this placement? And then they told us it was grey. And we were like, oh god, not again. And then we were on the beauty floor at grey. So we were basically doing like, we're not pivots. Those two fucking hairy idiots going in with a sort of floor full of just but what was good is they would they were brilliant. They were lovely there. They were really friendly. And then they got us a load of free prints and so it meant that when the Cream exhibition came out, we could have these massive, big, expensive prints. And then we were like, and then we had the Cream exhibition,
We saw Trev.
And we had two portfolios. No one else had two portfolios, and we had a chair. And that's what's, that was sort of separated, because sometimes innovation
becomes
like a chair. It was a chair, but it was round, and it was really hot. So you're like, look, we could do two people at the same time. We could talk about the pocket, but no one else seems to do it. And when we didn't drink, we were like, no, we're going to go in cold here. So we wouldn't make it. And it worked. We saw Trev, caught him, collared him, and he invited us to a drink thing by the TWA, where they were just sort of like a book thing. And then we got our portfolio into that, but we didn't realise it was an interview where they got all the portfolios, six of the best portfolios they'd seen, put them in, all the creatives had judged them, marked them, and so then they'd sort of go, first, second, third, whatever. And then there was the drinks thing, because it was half on the book and half on the team, on the people, which is a thing we still live by today. And then but we didn't know it was an interview, so we would just go along, meet these amazing creatives, get some advice, get some free booze. But all the other creatives there knew, so they were all really nervous. And sort of like, and they didn't tell us. No, we don't have a clue. And we, again, we weren't drinking. Like, we're not going to. Because it's quite easy when you're a young creative to, get distracted by the free bar kind of culture in advertising. And so, but we wanted to be on our, just be, not make idiots of ourselves and learn from everyone there. And, amazing creative partner at TWA. So it was just, for us, we were just incredibly naive and a bit jaded. We're like, we were part of how we work because we try not to. We did that day in the pub with all the creatives. So we got a call from Trev. Trev wants you to come in. He just wants you to come in and just say a quick thank you to all the creatives for their time. And again, naive, we just thought, all right. Listen to it now. Yeah. So we just went, that's fair enough. There we go. So we went in, then Trev kind of, he wheeled us out, and then all the creatives were there, 20 teams.
Yeah, something like that.
And they were all standing there, that's a bit scary. And then Trev had our portfolio in his hand, and he thought, oh, here we go. But he wasn't smiling, so that felt weird, that was weird. And he went, we looked at your book, lads, and we were like, we thought it was shit. We're like, hell yeah, another crushing defeat.
Public humiliation.
Exactly. In the town square. Yeah. And then he threw it in the bin. Like, fucking hell, all right.
it was great. So we got you a new book. And we were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. They had pulled out this like professional portfolio. I thought it was pretty much, yeah, it's a big cumbersome thing, like it should come with a handcuff.
Yeah.
To do that thing. And so you worked in that, and you opened up, there was a work inside two contracts. You're hired. And then everyone did a big round of applause, and then he went, and there's 100 quid, just go and get pissed for the weekend. There's your office over there. He said, welcome, Chris and John. There's campaign journalists. To get hired like that, democratically, not just the ECD, but, you know, the whole department rooting for you, was just such a lovely way.
And memorably, because, well, you know, he made a thing of it, you know, yeah, Trevor's brilliant at this. He made us feel very special and you know, wanted. And I think it was, and we'll never forget that. And then, you know, we try and do that with the teams we hire, because sometimes teams can go in on a placement and they'll be there for a bit and then someone will just go, oh, we want to get hired, just want to start working. And then they'll just start working and there's no fanfare or there's no big moment yet. It's first job. It's amazing. Yeah. And we're creative, so we can come around here, we can come up with interesting ways of making this feel special. So it was amazing. But then it meant that because we were so fucking hungry, for 2 years, just sort of dragging out. Yeah, but, you know, we didn't give up. Like, you know, Terminators just kept doggedly going on. But it's a bit bulking for us. Well, yeah. You know, Vic used to work at Mother, and now So he was in the year above us at Manchester. And when he left, he was really fucking smart, and he did this amazing final year project where he created this character called Obvious Bob, and it was all about branding, and he got that into everybody else's work. Managed to convince all the other people on the course to put Obvious Bob in their work. And anyway, so then when he left, there was a bidding war between Mother and HOTL over here.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we thought, when we were going to leave, this is going to be amazing.
Instead of not Nigel Bob,
yeah,
funeral suit, yeah.
When we did start, because it was still really scary, because, you know, we weren't proven. There's no placement. We didn't know any of the teams. They hadn't seen us at work. It was purely on that day out. But we were just like, we just got all the briefs because we were quick by that point. We weren't that precious because we had so much stuff rejected. Mickey O'Brien and Tor was just chilling. And it just meant that we were just on all the briefs and we were hungry. It was a John Smith's brief that had been knocking around the department and they hadn't really sort of got anything yet. So we sort of stole it, had a bit of crack at that.
Yeah.
And then we sort of ended up with the Peter Kay script. We sort of ended up working with Paul Silver. You know, we had this. Now, our first thing was that. It was the man with no nonsense, wasn't it? It was a cowboy thing. Yeah. And then it sort of shifted, and then we became PK, and we did that.
It was an amazing department, wasn't it? When we look back and you go, when we first joined, it was, you know, it was Paul Silver, Matt, Ben Murray, Seth, and Martin Bryan, and Ed and James.
Yeah.
Gorham, obviously.
Yeah, and was that we would work super close to them. We would be working in with the brief with the planners, and we would be there with the account lots sort of working out how to sell these things and learning off them and helping them. And suddenly we would get all this work through. People would go, why, how are you making all this stuff? You know, the creatives are just, because a lot of the creatives, no disrespect to them at all, because obviously you're amazing, but it would be very much a shut door thing, and then they go and then they pass it and then they go off and sell it. So, but we didn't know that way. We were sort of like, we just wanted a few mates to sort of help make this thing fun and make it a little bit easier and stuff. And, but it turned out that it was the best way of, you know, A, with the ideas, because, you know, working with the strategy, and then selling them on to the clients and understanding what they want. And stuff. But it's a good insight into just sharing yourself out and sort of, you know.
Yeah, just the whole kind of the label of a creative and how that can sometimes be a bit of a good fact, because it suddenly sort of confides, you know, if we're the creatives, then in effect that makes the rest of everybody in the process uncreative. And it sort of creates a weird division of labour when you want everybody to be excited and passionate about the things we're making. So we accidentally making friends with all the other people in the other disciplines and collaborating and getting loads of stuff out. And then we made really good, we sort of made a kind of a close working relationship with a guy called Andrew Sturck, who was a planner there. And he's now over, he's global planning director at Facebook now. But we the three of us became a team, you know, because he was super, super smart, highly educated, and we're not. But he was really creative, brilliant at writing, and, you know, we just really kind of gelled together, and we sort of found that me, Chris, we always feel like we need to spice up our marriage. You know, we were always inviting people into our marital bed. It does fucking sparkle eyes. Hello, whips, gems, masks, sharps, organograms, whatever it is, we don't care. Just love it in the mix. Keep it fresh. And love you, mate.
Yeah,
always. And I think we learned that then. You know, that because it was an amazing place, amazing craves to learn on. But it was one. A creative department and really quiet, doors shut. I mean, that's not how we work. But with Turkey, there was a point we'd been there for maybe 3 years, and I think he was getting the itch to sort of leave, and they didn't really want people to make it. And so they basically went, I want to start your own agency with it, like a paper now. I think about this, I don't know how they've managed to get it. To start a little bit of pain, and so he asked us if we wanted to do it. So Turkey, me and John started this agency called Upstart. Shit name.
So, you know, I've the listener.
Definitely Turkey. And we just started pitching it out. We started trying to win business. We pitched for Nickelodeon. Our first thing was Nickelodeon. We won it. Well, Nickelodeon was just down the road from us. So we had a lot of clients. We started doing work for Nickelodeon, and there's like Michael Showers, there's a Eurostar scheme. We did a website, some digital stuff for them back in the day. Not knowing anything about digital at all. And again, working with Nickelodeon, and obviously we would later go and work for Channel 4, so that was really useful. But completely winging it, absolutely winging the crap out of it. Pretending to be like 26, and winning pitches, but it was exciting. And again, I think, you know, come back to that naivety thing. We didn't really know what you were supposed to do in a pitch or how you're supposed to conduct yourself in a meeting when you're meeting clients. And so, you know, we sort of found our own way of doing it, and it worked. But as in a kids' TV channel kind of thing, because, our shtick is kind of sort of alcoholic to kids' TV presenters. You know, lots of jazz hands and just, you know, this is going to be amazing. Like, dodgy and dead something. But it lasted maybe a couple of years or maybe a year and a bit. But then it started doing quite well, and I think Trev stopped it because it was taking all our eyes away from, you know, the paying PlayStations and the Adidas's and the big paying clients and stuff. Yeah, which is fair. So we shifted back in, and then we got maybe about 4 years in. We sort of got. We're ranting on. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
I was just going to ask. Just on a specific piece of work, the Peter Kay thing, because Paul did some and you did some, how did that work? And because it won a bunch of awards, like, was that like, oh, fucking hell, we've done it. We've won all these awards now.
Yeah, I think, like,
So we came up with a very crude idea about no nonsense, and that was sort of doing a campaign where, because before it was all about showing the nonsense and then going no nonsense, and then and so we just thought it would be interesting to not have the nonsense in it. Or anyway, it sounds fucking absurd when you explain it. So then Sullivan came on, and then he brought Danny Kleiman and PK. So really, it was just, you know, from that point, it was just us just watching, listening, learning. And I mean, the three of them, when they got their banter on, it was impossible to kind of break into that. And we just write script after script after script after script. There's got to be something in one of these, and we were just learning and learning and learning. And then one of the scripts they liked, which was the No Nonsense Birds and Bees, but they were like, they weren't sure if it could go on telly and all this kind of stuff. But in the end, it was like the fifth of, you know, it was the last one on the line, wasn't it? Yeah, because the others, because we have habits, and they're all amazing, amazing scripts. But ours was sort of the random one, that it was sort of the viral one. They're pretty new, that, yeah, they didn't really exist. And so they're like, all right, well, maybe we can do this and stick it out on this internet thing. And so then we shot it off the back of another script, which was in the Curry House, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so, but it's brilliant. We kind of tweets with our portfolio, you know, they're all like, you know, you don't want to look studenty, no knock gags, no swearing, no nothing like that. And then the next thing we go, mate, it's a knock gag, yeah, it's the thing I've set. But it was, but what was brilliant, it was just, obviously the campaign was hugely successful, and our ads typically were shown on the BBC, they showed it on the BBC, talked about it, then you're like, that's wicked. Yeah. Things that need to be crossed over to a channel that can't show ads, yeah, they're talking about that over there, that's really, you know, and things like the Avid, things with the vernacular, and people talking about this, and it was eye-opening of, wow, you can sneak into culture, you can sort of do stuff as well. Yeah. But then, which is obviously that's one of Trev's,
yeah,
main, that's his thing, isn't it? So, but that definitely had a lasting impression. It wasn't like, yeah, we made it, because Trev, I think he's obviously had lots of praise come through the doors, and so he's had a well-rehearsed chat, which is, you know, don't act like two-year-olds, you know, staggering around with sit down in front thinking you own the place. you know, so like, and that resonated with us. Like, okay, you know, we may have had a little bit of success here, but it's, you know, we've still got a long way to go. But it was more that, you know, we want a load of stuff. And again, we were so naive, we didn't even know that that was a really great thing. Because we, you know, again, come from Manchester, we didn't have DNA annuals or anything like that. So we weren't really exposed to the whole award culture. So, you know, I remember people going, "Oh, you're going to do the walk tonight?" That's, what's the walk? And they were about laughing. And then it was brilliant. But then when it was over, and we didn't win anything for fucking years, and then the rot set in. It was more like that. It was like the absence of it. It was like, oh. And then we sort of realised how fucking hard it is to actually win something. To have a long, long time to get another one, didn't it? To have all those stars align, you know, just everything, just from, you know, direct from the idea, direct to the and it's just, but we just kept on making weird stuff and just trying stuff out and seeing what sort of stuff, you know, we made.
But we didn't always help ourselves
either. I think we always try and sort of push it sort of to the limits of, yeah, you know, making it almost unpalatable sometimes, and, you know, making it really absurd or really dark and really twisted, or a concept that just doesn't, you know, I think, and half the time I think you just twitch people off, don't you?
Always remember, because we did the mishap, the leave the extreme to the X-trail.
Yeah.
We did the items, which is this man hammering nails in his head.
Shoot. Just get it, fine. But and we got a place on this thing, and where we were given a window in Selfridges. So, but it was amongst a load of different creative types, so illustrators, so photographers, filmmakers, and stuff. And then we were like the ad guys. But we were just a bit like this, you know, sort of. But it was like bomb-proof glass. We realised our office was the identical size to the window, except this the window had a window. Ours didn't have a window. And our office was full of tats, as full of nonsense that we would just pour over to stick up on walls. Tony McTeer, who was at the bottom, so hated it. Like, he was, when are you going to grow up, lads? Come on. But we would just stick all this stuff up. But it meant that we would just literally shift it to stick it in the window itself. So visually, it was quite interesting. And then we just put ourselves there. We made ourselves a website. Yeah. Had a camera. What's it called? No, webcam. This is all new, then, by the way. Trailblazing stuff. Well, it was a webcam that would update every like 3 seconds because that was kind of the speed of the broadcast headset. And then we would sit there at our desks and we would work. We would work for 3 weeks in the window assumptions, and we didn't really do that much work because it was more fun to wave at people like full faces. Because for about half an hour, it's terrifying because everybody's looking at you, but then you realise you're a foot taller and you've got all this bomb-proof glass. So you get a kind of a sense of sort of security. Yeah, and then you just see, we're basically clowns. Well, no, we've been for 3 months. So we got because we had FCUK as a client, so we blanked a supermarket suite with FCUK where we had like 5 minutes to rest at the shop, get a load of clothes that we would wear for those 3 weeks. But then it's really hard. It's like really exciting. We got all this stuff, and then you try it all on later on, and none of them fit. So we're stuck with the same shirt and trousers you got to wear for 3 weeks. And then it was broadcast on the screen. And David Blaine was in the thing where he was in a glass box. Yeah, it was happening at a similar time. And so we ended up sort of doing stories about him in this glass box. And then we ended up doing a story. We wrote for the FT. Yeah. The FT, the Financial Times, asked us to write this piece just about our time in this box, in this window. Pretty weird because it was just sort of seemed a bit as I can't think of people stick themselves in glass boxes.
Yeah. It's weird, it's like we're not really, you know, we've never been sort of big, you know, self-promotion.
No.
We just thought it'd be a funny idea, but it turned out to be a really good piece of
did nowhere for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Service window. And then it was a lot of fun.
Then all these amazing creators there, and it was sort of a little bubble, and then suddenly people started leaving, and TVWA started changing, we were getting a little bit more responsibility, and then it kind of got a little bit, you know, the sparkle went a little bit, and we realised that actually, you know, you've got to, you know, I guess to your point of, you know, do we think we made it? I think at that point we realised, you know, you've got to keep grafting to make a career out of it. I think we've probably got a little bit like, hey, this is all cool and fun. And then, but Tony Matera had started, and he was sort of set himself apart from all the other creators, you know. And so he sort of say things like, all right, lads, right, what you got to do is you've got to steal Bruce. And we go, but Tony, you can't steal Bruce because, like, you know, don't listen to them. He's got steel breeze because nothing speaks louder than a good idea. I don't know why I'm giving him a Cockney accent because he's from the northeast.
Yeah.
But again, we're going with it. And then he's like, steel breeze. We're going to their office at night, right? When no one's there, nick their brief, work on it, crack it. There's fuck all they can do. And then we went home. And then we went into his office, and there was a brief, a PlayStation brief, and the handheld, you know, the TSP.
Yeah, because he was fucking copying it.
Yeah,
you know, he just made PlayStation Mountain amazing.
Yeah,
you know,
he's, you know, and then the Levi's twist is, yeah,
he's a way too much pencil.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah.
And he was hogging this PSP, this new PlayStation brief. So he stole it.
Right, and got ideas. And then went in the morning and he went, you fucking wankers.
Or something a bit stronger than that.
Yeah.
And he went, it's good, it's good. And then sold it. Then we worked with like Chris Cunningham on this weird little creature thing. It's wicked again. Tony and Daniel Taylor joined him, and they became sort of joint ETDs at TWA. But it was still sort of, you know, there's a lot of unrest, and people go, yeah, but Trip's not there, so it's not the magic stuff. But we were just like, all right, we need to grab, we need to like, keep going with these things. So we basically just, we offered ourselves up as their victims. We were just like, look, we want to help you, because we know this is, you know, you just give us any brief, we'll work on it, we'll graft for you, we'll help you out. And again, now being in that position, it's so good having teams who just, you know, you can rely on, they get something from them.
Yeah, exactly that, because we had, you know, we made some stuff, and it was good, and it was okay, so, but it just, you know, there were just ads that were made for clients and things, and we'd always use of stuff when we were making these, but we'd be writing a load of comedy, enter them into like a BBC, you know, comedy competition and get shortlisted and stuff, because we were just restless, we were just wanting to make stuff, and if, you know, because ads always felt a bit restricted to us, but it was, but we didn't have a home for this stuff, and when we started looking out in the world, it wasn't really sticking. People weren't really getting us.
You'd always hear that expression, you know, oh, you haven't made that ad yet. And then, oh, we made the John Smith thing. Like, yeah, but that was ages ago, and that was with Sylvan and Danny Climbing anyway. And there was just, you know, you kind of just you're a limbo in between us, a creative limbo.
Yeah, completely.
And so we thought, well, why don't we just put all that creative energy into a second portfolio? And it sort of goes back to being at university, because we write our dissertation and Chris would write a second one because he was a massive geek.
But then you'd write a second
one. Because I'm really, really competitive, I would write a second one and almost break myself doing that. So we just thought, well, let's like we did at uni, let's do a second book, which is about our personality, not about like end result. And then it was very us. I mean, you can see it on our site. You know, it's all like Photoshop, like marker and everything. just put it all in there. And Fallon said, you know, that was the reason he gave us the job at Fallon, and was because that showed our potential and our personality. And we've sort of advised a lot of teams to do that over the years.
You want us, because, you know, we understand that, you know, it's tough to get these ads out, that, you know, the stars are aligned and they're amazing. So, but, you know, we know there's obviously some bright sparks of people and they can be doing their own thing or different ways of selling themselves. So it worked for us. And then it meant when we started, it was similar to when we joined TWA, wasn't it? It was just literally, it's not it's like John Smith was our first brief there and we're super hungry. And this was something like, all right, cool, this is the place. And then literally, because we hadn't met Rich then, we'd met Twan. So our first intro to Rich was on our first day, where he sort of brought us into it, what you want, lads? Yeah. And then I got a brief for you, didn't say hello. And it was the scope brief, and then that was our first brief.
Yeah.
We just sort of just hold ourselves up and do that. So, yeah, it's amazing. Because again, we were just hungry. We were like, well, you know, we're in this. Like,
we weren't going to go for Fallon either.
No, that's right.
Yeah. So we owe Danny, we'll all forever owe Danny Taylor a beer for this.
You haven't given it to me yet, though.
But yeah, because we thought, Fallon. Because at that point, you know, it's pre-Gorilla, so it was still a little bit DDB and really thoughtful, and our stuff was weird, odd, wacky, strange shit, and so we just thought, we don't really fit there, so we almost didn't go.
They're not going to like us because we're not like them.
Yeah.
But then you realise that, yeah, but they've got loads of really clever people who can do those type of ads, but they don't want another person like that because they've already got them, so they want someone a bit different. So then. Like, oh, yeah, that's going to be cool. And Danny was just, oh, why haven't you spoken to Rich? Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, he just sort of got in. And then,
it's amazing how many times you hear it all the time. Go, oh, that place is a sweatshop. Yeah. Oh, that place doesn't do any TV. Oh, that place has lost its... Like, you close it all down. And then you kind of make life really hard for yourself. So we're always telling teams, you know, just...
Don't say, just go make your own opinion, go and meet the people, go and get in there, go and the arts and stuff. But Fallon was on a high, because it was like literally, it was the year when they'd done Sony Balls, the year before, and then it was just, and then the year that we joined was the year with Gorilla, Sony Paints, and then Skoda Cake that we did, It was just, and the place was just, it was just this confidence, and it was big, and you could get away with stuff, and you could do these big, for real, everything was for real suddenly. Yeah. It was like, you have to do this thing. No, we're actually going to drop a million balls down a hill. Yeah. No, we're actually going to make a car okay. No, we're actually going to explode. Yeah. It was just like, you're going to do what? Like, yeah, no, it has to be for real. It has to be for real.
Or IRL, as it's known.
Yeah. As the kids say.
And, but that's, you know, it was,
when we first started TVWA, you know, it's packed full of amazingly like talented people, and you know, I mean, they've all sort of, you know, huge chunk broken off, and then they're all anomaly in New York and smashing it over there.
Yeah,
and it was a really inspiring kind of place to be. And Rich was incredible. Like, because Rich and Andy, they just split up just before, or Andy went off to do directing just before we joined. So we never really knew Andy. Obviously, you know, Rich was our boss, and he's incredible. He sort of taught us how, you know, he was always trying to make the world better with anything. He would always be, his heart is absolutely in the right place. It's always about trying to, you know, oh, okay, how can we solve the world? We've got all these ashtrays, but no one's smoking. How can we turn these ashtrays into a thing to make the world better? We're like, what? Why not? We're trying to work on a carpet. What? You know, he would just, everything is, or how can you do the right thing for that person, that one person who's part of, you know, it was such a brilliant lesson. It made everything super difficult, but it was done for the right reason.
Yeah.
And it made you, you know, when most people, you were this, you know, slag off the client, and et cetera, and all that kind of. But he never did that. He always try and listen to their feedback and try and find something in it to work with. He just didn't see things the same way. No, I was something was saying, you know, it was like you take him an apple when you're presenting work to him. You take him an apple and you go, nice banana. What have you thought about a pear? You know, it's just like 10 fucking steps ahead of everybody else, and it was really inspiring. But like, you know, it was constantly questioning everything, all rules of engagement.
Yeah,
and so it was really frustrating. And
you'd be doing like a week when you're doing it. You're like, so why is this all like this? Can you not just turn it upside down and make it black and white? Yeah. You're like, what? Well, let's not break. We can't. Every frame, every second takes a
week. You can never say the word can't.
No.
And then you walk on set and everybody's backs will go up. Because you're like, oh, fuck. What's he going to suggest? Like they tell you that they can't really shoot. You know, and then he just sat there really quiet and everyone's really cautious. And then he just looked at the boards and just went, we're not shooting the boards over.
Because that's what the clients agreed to. Oh man! But he would only make things better. So he would always, because he would be reacting to the thing because it's not good enough, or it could be made better, and or he would force you to just rethink a thing or to look at the thing again. And it was amazing. So we've sort of got Richards on our shoulder that just to, you know, we'll second guess it, third guess it, fourth guess it.
Just fuck it up.
Yeah, that was his phrase. Just fuck it up. And then now we say it, and I'm sure it gets on people's tips. But it's just anything that feels predictable or like an ad, you know, he was just pathologically, diametrically opposed to it.
Yeah.
He was incredible. No, he is incredible. You know, it's amazing. So we learned loads off him, basically. You know, I'm sure. Try and do a little bit of that to the creatives here and directors here and stuff, but no, Callum was amazing. But again, it was a similar trajectory to TVWA in that, you know, he was on a high and then Rich sort of left and then it's sort of
hang on before you get all maudlin about it. Could you talk about the whole thing about cake? Because I think people would want to know, like, how the fuck did that really happen and what was it like on the set and things like that. I just didn't want to skim past cake and go into the later parts of Fallon.
Yeah, that was good. No, it was, but again, it's sort of like, the thing about Cake was that we learn how important it is when you have a really strong relationship with the club, right? And because they're the ones, we learn that they're the ones that are taking the risk, really. You know, we all like to think of ourselves as brave risk takers, groundbreaking, you know, trailblazers, and it doesn't matter. We're paid to have ideas, and if one doesn't, if one's okay, we'll come up with another one. But client put a lot more on the plane than just how creative something is, or and Mary was the Skoda client. She was amazing. And she, without her, you know, it wouldn't have worked, because she, not only did she buy the idea, she was wicked. She took that shit. You know, she hated all of the big swinging dick ads, as she called it. You know, sort of kind of macho car stuff and imagery. And but what she basically, thanks to her, like she had to take this idea about turning, you know, her car into cake, not showing any metal at all. You know, in 60 seconds of car ads, no metal, no driving anywhere, you know, no, like, no cool, sexy corners, nothing. And she had to go and sell it into the factory in Dusseldorf and to dealers up and down the country. You know,
a man called Axel.
Yeah, his actual name is Axel.
Yeah.
Just like cars, he was called Axel, you know, he used to work in pharmaceuticals.
Excellent.
But they're just people who just, they're a really macho industry, and then we're going to, you know, turn their fucking thing that they've been researching and engineering into cake, into, you know, Victoria sponge. And so she did all that, and we sort of helped create things for her to kind of sell it in. And she got it sold in, and it was quite a long process. And we just thought, you know, that we know from now on we need to make sure that we're as close to the client as possible, because that's how you get great work through.
We got full of lovely stuff. We thought, yeah, we're not those macho guys. That's not us. We're not that at all. We're not car guys. You know, we're sort of more cape guys. And so it's full of lovely stuff, because the brief was a bit generic. It was so generic. It just, it had lots of really good stuff in it, lots of nice details, like, you know, chilled glove compartments and sunglasses holders, that kind of stuff. Nothing really to say.
I think the line was like, it's not great, but it's good.
It was like, great, brilliant, like, love it, amazing.
Well, I like that, because it was honest. So remember, Tom, the planner, was just like, I'm just, this is what it is. That's what it is. It's got loads of little gadgety things, and that's it. So we were like, cool, a good, honest strategy that knows the product that knows that it's not the best product. It was quite refreshing.
And then just say it the way that people say it, you know, which you know, Rich and Fallon and Brilliant, you know, it's a Skoda Honest and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it was just full of lovely stuff. And then we were just sort of rambling around what to make it. We were like, cars made of cats and all this kind of stuff. And then it was Valentine's Day, and we had to get out of the office just to get a bit of, you know, change of scenery. And we were sharing a cake because it was Valentine's Day again, keeping the relationship interesting and, you know, keeping the love alive. And it was that. It was just like, oh, let's just make it out. It was a high stake cookie. Yeah. It was just, let's make it out of cake. That's cool, isn't it? But again,
at that time it was like, right, so we'll make a car out of cake, full of this stuff, and we'll have it driving around corners and doing all that car stuff.
Yeah.
And then we saw Rich, and he was just like, don't make it drive, lads. Hearing my shit. Yeah. We're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then we thought, well, what if we actually make a cake?
Out of cake. It has to be all out of cake.
Yeah.
It has to be edible. And that was the one thing we saw so many directors. They were like, oh, yeah.
But before that, we were like, well, it's something out of cake. And we thought, well, what are you seeing? And we thought, well, actually, it's the cake being made by the bakers.
Yeah.
And then that shows the craft of the engineering. And then we'll put a giant cherry on top. and ruin it. You know, like, we make it good, and then we go to Rich, and you go, that's just a joke on a joke. You don't. So it's like, we'd always make it shit, a bit shit, and then Rich would kind of sort of put it back. And then we sort of got the script to pretty much how it was.
Saw a lot of directors,
but not in a memory sold it in, and we sort of made that, got this made relationship. And then we just really struggled to find a director, because we kind of ran out of time because it was so long to sell it in. And none of them wanted to do it for real. They wanted to post it.
We'll do half, we'll do those bits, but the rest will be model made or made out of whatever.
Yeah.
Or whatever. He's just like, no, it's got to be that. It's got to, again, be naive and stupid, not fully understanding that this thing is going to be, it has to be done in like a few weeks, and it's really expensive and like a huge risk. And then it was Chris Palmer who came in and went, yeah, we'll do it all, okay? Of course we will.
Yeah.
But again, he was a bit like us in the Evelyn Rupert. He just kind of looked at me like crazy eyes. Like, what are you saying? You can't promise this. Because he didn't know how he was going to do it, but he went and go, yeah, we can do this. Well, absolutely, we'll do this. Yeah, cool. And we're like, wicked, we like you, let's
a weird little journey together. And then it was just about pulling in all very clever cake makers and model makers. And it was just, you know, there's moments where we were like, oh no, it's all going to be about sponge. The whole thing was sponge. We're going to do like Christmas, you know, sort of Christmas sponges, you know, fruit sponges, whatever. But it was just the weight of it would have just fallen itself. And then it was someone was like, well, why don't we just build it like a car? Build it out of these panels. So, but out of something like a Rice Krispie cake. It was like, so then you've got a sponge there. And then it was just the fun of going, Jay likes, you know, syrup oil. It was just fun. And we hadn't everything locked down when we started this thing. That was a 4-day shoot. There was only so much prep we could do because we can't make it twice. You can't do a test one and do it. So it was a 4-day shoot. And then it was just kind of being built. What you see is it. It was being built from start to scratch.
So basically, the art department, we just put them in. The people you see are the people who actually made it. They're the art department. I think the Queen's ISO, and some guy who works on Star Wars. And we put them all in the outfit.
And the company, the Madeira sponge, so there's, because it was really tight, timing and stuff, and there's no one who could make that amount of Madeira sponge in time, but they found this little cake shop, I can't remember where it was, that was going out of business. But they thought, she was like, okay, no, I can do this. So she made all the Madeira sponge, we were laying it all down at the start. And then, but then post the ad, she sold, you know, bricks from the, you know, as seen on the Skoda cake ad, and her business then took off.
Wow.
You know, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. She was about to close up shop, and then, yeah, she helped us out, and we helped her out. It's amazing. But there's loads of stuff that we hadn't worked out, so we didn't know what we were going to do for the engine. We didn't know what we were going to do for the lights. And so there's things like, we were sitting there, and we were getting Rich, sort of, no, it was Rich and his kids.
Yeah,
we were sitting there and we were just gluing Glassier Mints together. Sort of sticking Glassier Mints to become the front light. And the engine, we were like, we just had this big block of sponge. And we were like, okay, cool, we need to make
Simon.
Yeah, the client. He admits himself, you know, I don't get creative, don't get it. And so, again, bringing clients in and making them, we were like, oh, come there, come. You know engines. We don't know engines, we know cake, you know engines.
Together,
we can make a beautiful engine, cake engine.
Yeah.
And then we sort of sat there, we were just sort of, you know, chopping things. And he's like, no, you can't use a fig roll for a manifold sprocket. It's stupid. That's got to be a chopper bourbon. We're like, amazing, they're perfect. And that, so suddenly we've got a realistic engine on our hands.
Yeah,
and you know, got the client involved in the process, and the client became a really good ally, and all the other stuff that we worked on.
Yeah,
but then Mary the whole time, because you know, every hour something would go wrong, like the ovens would break, or the, you know, something would fall off, and so she just sat there rubbing her face, going bright red, smoking a lot,
did it,
but she held her nerve, but there's loads of stuff. There's like, the wing mirror was a stick of rock with Skoda written inside the stick of rock. And then the wing mirror was, because it was an orange car and it had a brown bottom and dipped into chocolate. It was silly, that. But it was all there. Everything was all the details that were in this thing. And it was, and then you're obviously just eating everything. Well, like, I remember Chris Farley getting really stressed out. And he just inhaled like four flakes out of stress. It was like a really deranged moment. But then it worked. It looked like the car, thank God. And it was amazing. And then, you know, so it was right at the end on the fourth day. And it was like, look at that, I've got a car, right? Everyone go behind it and we'll take that final shot. And it was such a bit. But then it was like, all right, then we need to edit this thing. And we didn't know what music was going to be on it. And then Paul at the quarry, and so he,
Paul Watts
does it, and so he you know, found the music, and obviously everyone fell instantly in love with it. It's perfect. But Julie Andrews has never approved a music track on anything, you know. So it's like, but it's perfect. But we can't get hold of it. And then we were looking at re-recording loads, but they just didn't have. Magic. It was just, there's something missing all the time for it. And again, it was just, I was right up to the last minute, wasn't it? We were sitting in the pub just going, yeah, but it's not as good. It just sounds the same and stuff. And we got a phone call saying that someone had written, they had to handwrite a letter to her to be delivered to her house to show the ad. And she'd seen it, loved it, and then approved it, but the day before it was airing, the day before it was out.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, oh, man. So she, and it, yeah, it was right up, the whole thing was right up until the last minute.
Yeah.
It was the most stressful thing, but it worked again, stars aligned. It was just like, it was amazing, and on so many levels, because it was, we did it. You know, everyone put everything into it. No one wanted this thing to fail.
It was all good for us, because everything we made up until that point tended to veer on the kind of, you know, dark, subversive, you know, head fuck kind of approach. We hadn't really, you know, we almost shied away from doing anything that would kind of maybe almost like scared to do anything that would be popular, because in case it wasn't popular.
Yeah.
But like, so it was amazing to kind of do something that everybody loved, and to realise that you don't have to swear, you don't have to, you know, make a sexual innuendo or etc. You don't have to be wacky. You don't. Sometimes it just has to be, you know, be nice, be fun in your work, and that can be equally as impactful. And
yeah.
So yeah, it was a bit of a learning.
And that process. was that ad, you know, when people were saying you haven't done that ad, that was that ad. So how did that change, like, your standing and stuff like that, and the kind of place you were in Fallon? And people must have seen you differently after that ad.
The cake flats after that for a long time, which is why I'm happily the cake, you know, cake flats. But it was weird at Fallon, like, and the thing is, because obviously, while we were making that, because Nikki Barnes is our producer, amazing producer, and you know, she was also making Gorilla with Quan. So that was going on at the same time, and it's all weird. It's like, in any other year, Cake would have been the ad of that year. You know, not saying arrogantly, it was an amazing bit of film. But then Quan made a fucking drunk Gorilla, totally kind of trumped it, and you know, and he won all the big things. And so even though Cape was really successful, it wasn't Gorilla, and so that kept us hungry and kept our feet on the ground.
It was really annoying. But for Fallon as an agency, it was Cape, Gorilla, and Cape in 1 year.
Yes.
Lucky, huh?
You go, it's not many things. But yeah, it's not a bad lineup.
I remember going to some parties and we were, oh, where do you work? And Fallon, and they just winced and just went, oh, piss off. It really was like a weird, like an amazing kind of place to be in. Like, it burned so bright for a short period of time, and then obviously sold to publicists and, you know, moved office, brought in Asda, and, you know, did a few kind of things that just changed its DNA, and it lost its...
But again, we were always searching for weird stuff and different shaped things, and, you know, we started looking after Cadbury's, and after Gorilla, so we didn't do Gorilla, we did all bits after Gorilla, all bits that no one remembered, that was us.
Yeah.
So, we've got this Blast and a Half Full production, you know, this amazing idea, and this that produces things that can bring you joy, so it was about that. Jumping into musicals, we do Fast Novel Records, or the fashion, where we did the things with Charles Deakin, or, you know, we did this weird thing for Spots and Stripes for the Olympic Games, which didn't work. It's huge, did not work. No one played this thing, it's a big, stupid game. But as part of it, we made two number one selling chocolate bars. And you're like, that's Willy Wonka's stuff. That's awesome. So even though, you know, it's just, we were trying to find weird shape stuff within, you know, this kind of swirl of panic and uncertainty, but it's sort of, you know, again, it's sort of same as the two ways.
We were on the prowl to kind of, because we made two 60-second ads that had been successful, so we were sort of desperately on the hunt to make something else, something different. We didn't know what it was, and obviously digital was the buzzword of the day by this point. Before that, it was, you know, ambient media and guerrilla marketing, and now it's digital, so and integrated. So we were sort of, you know, dabbling in that, and to varying degrees of success. But I think, like, we
it kind of fell into that trap that a lot of creatives do, which, and I think you've written about it under a blog before, which is, you know, right, I'm going to be a creative director now. And so we made ourselves creative director on about 5 or 6 accounts.
Yeah.
So like Budweiser, Powerade, Cadbury, Allman Insurance, Budweiser,
Maynard's,
and Comic Relief.
And we're like, man, loads of stuff. Something's got to stick.
Yeah.
Something's got to be good at all this.
Our reason was, if we're signing off, then we're going to, we've removed a layer of resistance. And if we're signing off, then we're also, you know, going to be working with the client. And now we know that clients are your allies. So we did that. You know, we found ourselves kind of, and this is no criticism to, you know, traffic project manager roles. We found ourselves sort of becoming like creative traffic handlers, because we get the work from the teams, and then we choose what we thought was best, and then we go to Rich, and then he blow it all out or contradict us, and then we'd have to go back to the teams. And it was, but I think, like, you know, It was really hard work, really, really exhausting, and you. But it kind of taught us that, you know, don't you know, be careful what you wish for, and don't chase it before it's time. You know, it taught us that, but equally it taught us, you know the more you do yourself, the smaller the process, the better. Which is what we found at Four Craven later on.
And
we were just on the path that Cravens take. You know, we were junior, middleweight, senior. We went to the Craven director, you know, and then ultimately in our minds we were like, we want to be ECDs or own our own shop. That was always our guiding light. It was just the path you take, and that's kind of what we, you know, because we do enjoy
this. Is weird, because that's not why we did it. You know, we were obsessed with HKCL, and the fact that everything they did was different than innovative and left field. And yet somehow we ended up losing that and getting into some, the race to the top.
Yeah,
to be in the club, the ECD club.
Yeah,
and then you get there, and you're like, what's all that about?
But it's all because we got an itch. Because we were going to leave Fallon, and then they didn't want us to leave, and they were like, oh, what can we do? We're like, well, we want to be ECDs. So they're like, oh, we can help you. So we stuck us on a load of courses, like presentation courses, which on paper sounds really boring and dull, but actually they were really good. They were like big confidence boosters. Just the idea of standing up in front of a load of people and telling your story and making them, you know, like it and all that kind of stuff. And sort of we became creative partners, but there's like 5 of us running the department, so there wasn't really one. You know, again, you need that one figure, you know, or two as in our case, but you need one vision, as it were, not 5. And so it kind of just didn't work. You know, it was with Sam and Shish and Santi, and we were all mates, it was all wicked, but it just wasn't working as a thing. And then we got headhunted for this place.
Hang on, wait. Got to go to work in about 5 minutes, and also we're about to get into Four Creative and all that sort of stuff, and I think like it'd be a good time to do a part two at another occasion if we can get that together and do also some other things. I wanted to ask you a bit more about the Cadbury side of Fallon and what it was really like there and some other bits and pieces there. So I think there's another hour of stuff that we could get out of it, but I can't do another hour now, unfortunately.
Yeah, we could do it next week.
Okay,
brilliant. We could do it next week. Let's get it done. Otherwise, it will drag on, and then we'll end up, because we leave here in about 3 weeks. So,
okay.
And then we're going on holiday for a bit, and then we'll start a new place, and we'll go dark. So I reckon that's sounds great. If
perfect.
You're around, if you want part two, if you want part two,
we'll do part two.
Do you edit it at all?
Yeah. I edit out. I mean, there's been bits where the sound fell out a little bit, so I'll put that together. And if people say too much, I'll take out a few But otherwise, I don't change it really. I just make it a little bit easier to hear. But that's some great stuff in there. And thank you hugely for your time. And we'll do it again next week.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Nice
one,
cool. Right. Oh, and Gabby sends her love, by the way.
I'll see you next week. Yeah.
Okay. Cheers.
Yeah, happy birthday to Gabby. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, happy
birthday. Yeah. Bye.
podcast on What's Christmas.